Okay, so I'm going to talk about some work that I did, at least initially, with Joan Pitelli and Ricardo Mosna, who are both Brazilian students, now with permanent positions in São Paulo. One way to pose at least one of the fundamental questions of quantum gravity is that we want to understand what the smallest scale structure of space-time is, or the smallest scale structure of whatever it is that replaces space-time at that scale, or the structure at whatever replaces the idea of smallest scale at smallest scales. It would be considerable progress if we even knew how to pose the question. Now, there is an obvious way to answer this, which is to just go quantize gravity and then work it out. Unfortunately, I have not yet figured out how to do that. So I am going to talk about a more modest sort of general approach, which is to look at ways in, to look at characteristics that might be universal enough that they don't depend on a particular quantum theory of gravity, but at the same time can maybe tell us something important. The classic example of that, of course, is black hole thermodynamics, which can be derived without committing to string theory or loop quantum gravity or any other particular quantization of gravity, but which presumably tells us a great deal about what to look for in a true quantum theory of gravity. So the way in that I'm going to talk about today is to ask what the effect of quantum fluctuations of matter is on the small scale structure of space-time. But I have to say, when I started working on this, I thought that it would be a reasonably straightforward and fairly dull project that I could do with some students who needed to get something done in a few months visiting. It has turned out to be much more interesting and maybe more important than I had expected. So let me set the framework a little bit. There are two kinds of fluctuations, quantum fluctuations, that you can talk about. In Larry Ford's terms, and I'm not sure if this was originally his, these are active and passive fluctuations. Active fluctuations are fluctuations of the metric because the metric is quantized. That's hard because that really does need a quantum theory of gravity. Passive fluctuations are fluctuations of the geometry in response to fluctuations of the stress energy tensor of matter. And that is potentially easier to understand. Now, there are nice ways in principle of making clean separations, for example, by using large numbers of matter fields and doing a 1 over n expansion. I'm not going to worry about that level of precision. I'm going to just say that I'm going to be looking at fluctuations of the stress energy tensor and ignoring the more deeply quantum mechanical effects of the metric. Although, if you like, you can think of small quantum fluctuations of a metric around some background as being quantized and contributing to these passive fluctuations. Now, how do you measure the effect of such things? Well, one way is to look at what they do to beams of light, that is to look at the Ray-Chaudhry equation, which tells you how the expansion, that's the derivative of the logarithm of the area of a cross section of a beam of light, how it changes along that beam of light. Semi-classically, that is treating the the expansion, shear, and vorticity as being non-quantum. Semi-classically, expansion focuses light rays, shear focuses light rays, vorticity defocuses, but at this level of approximation, if the vorticity is initially zero, it remains zero. So we can just look at beams of pencils of light where omega is initially zero. And so the interesting thing is what the Ricci tensor or the stress energy tensor does. Now, this is not a new question, of course, and there's been a lot of work in the past on looking at small numbers of correlation functions and so on. What has really changed in the past 2 or 3 years is that Fuster, Ford, and Roman have, for the first time, given us a really good picture of the full probability distribution of fluctuations of the stress energy tensor, one that is exact for two-dimensional conformal field theories and is pretty good for four-dimensional, at least four-dimensional massless theories.
So, I'm make sure I'm getting the point. I mean, there's been a lot of talk about, this is the null energy condition that you want to know about in the quantum theory, and so people usually look at the expectation value of the stress tensor, and that can be a little bit negative, or then they look at integrals of that over multi-Dsig or something.
Right.
So you're not looking at the expectation
value? I'm not looking at the expectation value. Let me tell you what. Let me tell you what Fuster, Ford, and Roman have done, which will explain, which I was about to do anyway, which might answer that question. What they said is, let's take correlation functions of an arbitrary number of stress energy tensors, or particularly of some particular components of stress energy tensors. And let's ask whether those correlation functions are the correlation functions, are identical to correlation functions that come from some probability distribution, which you can then interpret as saying, well, this is quantum mechanics, there are various probabilities of the stress energy tensor taking various values. So to do that, you have to, in principle, look at all correlation functions. And you also have to have some conditions obeyed that tell you that if you know all of the moments of a probability distribution, that determines the distribution. For two-dimensional conformal field theories, they can do both of those. And they have an exact probability distribution. And it turns out that the important part of this distribution is the extreme tail, which is something that doesn't show up if you just look at expectation values or even first order fluctuations around expectation values. For four dimensions, they can't do that well, but they have they have estimates for the probability distributions that are under good control at both ends and that fit very reasonably well for the low moments and very well for the higher moments.
Are the probability distributions integrated components?
These are probability distributions of stress energy tensors smeared over some finite interval or some finite volume. And what? I'm sorry, say that again.
Okay.
So, I mean, you take the, in order for these correlation functions to make sense, you have to smear the stress energy tensor over some characteristic volume. I'll take the smearing to be plank size.
They're all centered at the same point.
No. Yes, to get the, yeah, to get the probability distribution, they're all centered at the same point.
And they do it for all components of the stress sensor, or just some null components?
Well, for the two-dimensional theory, they do it for all components. There, the trick is that there are various recursion relations that I think go back to Belavin and Knishnik of what happens when you add an additional stress tensor to a correlator. They write down a generating function for the moments and use those recursion relations to develop a differential equation, which they can solve exactly for a Gaussian smearing. For four dimensions, they can't do that, but what they do is they calculate hundreds of moments, or they have a computer calculate hundreds of moments, and then use a combination, then use various theorems from statistical theorems to put some pretty sharp limits on the tails on both ends of the distribution, and then look for fits coming from what they know is happening at both ends to that give the set of moments and get very good.
For what
four-dimensional? They do this for massless scalars and for electromagnetism.
Interacting massless scalars?
Non-interacting, free. And this is done in a flat space-time, although for two dimensions that is almost irrelevant because that just changes the conformal anomaly. In four dimensions, the argument is that if you're looking at fluctuations at small enough scales, the space-time should be near enough flat that it should at least give you a good approximation.
And is this supposed to be in the vacuum state?
Or yes.
It's the vacuum state.
The vacuum state, yeah. Okay, so one of the basic results, and I'll explain this in much more detail shortly, is that most of the vacuum fluctuations are negative, typically 80 or 85%. However, there is a sharp lower bound on the fluctuations. The exact value is determined by your smearing parameter. There is an infinite positive tail. So this runs you right into basic result in probability theory called gambler's ruin, which is the statement that if you're betting against a house that has an infinite amount of money, you will always lose in the end. There will always be a large enough fluctuation in the house's favor to wipe you out. So here what's going on is that qualitatively, there's a sharp limit to the negative energy fluctuations. There's an infinite positive tail. If you wait long enough, and what main thing that we've been trying to do is figure out what long enough means, there will be a positive fluctuation, that is a fluctuation that focuses light rays, that is large enough to cause the expansion to go to minus infinity. Here's a back of the envelope estimate of that. So I've written down the Ray-Chaudhry equation again. I'm going to ignore shear, which at most will increase the focusing. I'll assume that the vorticity is zero. And so the relevant pieces are the expansion and the stress energy tensor. The stress energy tensor, as I said, has a minimum value. It's negative, but there's a bound on how negative it can be. I'm calling theta max the amount of expansion for which the expansion term and the stress energy term at its most negative balance each other. Now, that, of course, isn't really the maximum expansion, but if the expansion gets larger than theta max, the right-hand side is negative, and it's quickly pushed down towards theta max. And for two dimensions, at least, we've run full simulations that show that the expansion really does just hang around something close to theta max most of the time, simply because the probability distribution is very sharply peaked at its most negative value. The next thing to notice, though, is that if the expansion ever becomes less than minus theta max, then the right-hand side is negative again, and it is more negative than any negative energy fluctuation can ever compensate for, because this is at most minus theta max, minus 1/2 theta max squared. So as soon as you have a fluctuation that puts you below minus theta max, below this critical value, the nonlinearities of the Rich-Chaudhry equation force you down to infinity, to minus infinity, pretty quickly. So here is a quick and dirty back of the envelope estimate, which turns out to be remarkably good. Let's take some smearing length or smearing time delta t, and let rho be the probability of a positive fluctuation in the vacuum energy large enough to push you down below minus theta max. If we just treat these fluctuations as independent, which is not quite true but is not a bad approximation, and we just ignore everything except the most negative fluctuations and the most positive fluctuations, then what's going on, you can think of it as a Poisson process, and you can read off what the distribution is of times that it takes, the amount of time it will take before you get a fluctuation big enough to push you down below this critical value. And the answer is that it's an exponential distribution, and that the mean value is the smearing time divided by the probability. And what we'll see is that this probability is typically somewhere between 0.15 and, I'm sorry, between 0.06 and 0.015, depending on exactly what theory. So in roughly between 15 and 75 or 80 times the smearing time, the tail, the extreme positive tail of this distribution of fluctuations is going to cause your light rays to converge. So this is something nobody saw before because nobody knew anything about this positive tail. And when you're just looking at expectation values or two stress tensor correlators or three stress tensor correlators, you don't see that tail. But
you're smearing on the Planck scale.
So yeah.
This is going to happen very quickly.
Yes, so it happens very quickly. But it happens slowly enough that maybe you can hope that this approximation of ignoring the actual quantization of gravity is all right. So let me start with a little more detail with a simple model of two-dimensional dilaton gravity, because this is the case where the probability distribution is known exactly. Now, if you're in two dimensions, there is no expansion, there is no shear, there isn't really a Rich-Chaudhry equation, but there is something very close. If you think of this two-dimensional action as coming from dimensional reduction of a four-dimensional action, then the dilaton here is essentially the transverse area. And so there ought to be something like the Rich-Chaudhry equation for the log of the dilaton. And in fact, there is. You can define an expansion-like variable, which is the derivative of the log of phi, and it does satisfy a Ray Chowdhury-like equation, which is essentially the same as the Ray Chowdhury equation, except for the absence of the shear term and slightly different coefficients. Now, what Fuster, Ford, and Roman showed is that if you look at the null-null component of the stress-energy tensor for a two-dimensional conformal field theory with a central charge C, the probability distribution for that component can be worked out exactly and is uniquely determined by the moments and is given by a truncated shifted gamma distribution. I mean, here's the formula, it doesn't matter so much, except that there's an exponential drop off there. Omega minus omega naught is the negative energy cutoff, which is just given in terms of the central charge. And as I said, there's an infinite positive, though exponentially decreasing tail.
Tau is smearing?
Tau is the smearing. Yeah, we're smearing over a time tau. So tau will be the Planck time, roughly. Though one of the things that I hope to do is talk to some observational astronomers about what kinds of fluctuations they need to correct for when they do adaptive optics and see whether if you smear over those lengths, whether there's any chance of seeing quantum fluctuations there.
So Steve, this is again, the probability distribution for one operator smeared in one place.
Yes.
So if I wanted to really study, just to ground myself, if I wanted to really study a given null G that propagates along, I really want to know the joint probability distribution of the stress tensor here and here and here,
right,
and correlations among these.
Yes. I'll say a little bit about that a little bit later. There are correlations, but they die off very, very rapidly as soon as you have separations of more than two times the smearing length.
This is Gaussian smearing?
This is Gaussian smearing. You can get, for Gaussian smearing, it can be done analytically. But you can look at Lorentzian smearing, for instance, and look at the moments, and there's very little difference. The minimum value can be computed exactly, and there are small numerical differences, and the distribution, well, the moments can be computed and are very nearly the same. So a couple of features of this distribution, 84% of the fluctuations are negative. The probability of a large positive fluctuation, that is one that's big enough to push you past this critical value, is 0.065. So from that back of the envelope estimate, you would say that the time for collapse of your pencil of light should be 14 Planck times or 15 Planck times or so. So what we did, or what my Brazilian collaborators did, was to write a program in Mathematica in which they ran 10 million simulations of this, each treating each step as an independent stochastic fluctuation. So that comes back to this issue of correlations. And to see what happens. So independent fluctuations, but chosen according to this probability distribution. So this is the time for the expansion to diverge to minus infinity. The bars are the numerical results. The dark line is that back of the envelope estimate, and it is remarkable how well it fits beyond the first step. I don't quite understand why the fit is that good, but it is.
And you just think about looking at larger smearings. If I did this only smearing things over optical or gamma ray wavelengths as opposed to the Planck scale.
There are some extra factors of the smearing time over the Planck time that come in.
And
I believe that it's 2, but it's been a while since I worked that out. It is something that I think might be at the edge of cosmological observability, but I got distracted and don't remember the numbers.
But you're saying, roughly speaking, if you put in a gamma ray wavelength, it might be the time for this to happen is sort of roughly the age of the universe.
Yeah, something of that order. Or I think a little bit less than the age of the universe. So to give you more of a feel for what's happening, here are a few particular runs in these simulations. So you start at expansion 0, just convenient place to start. Most of the fluctuations, vacuum fluctuations, are negative, so they very quickly push you up to this theta max. And you pretty much hang around there with little fluctuations, sometimes big positive fluctuations, but not enough to do anything dramatic. Then negative fluctuations are so much more common, they'll push you back up until one of these large fluctuations comes along, pushes you below the critical value, and then you just plunge to minus infinity. This is similar one. You see various positive energy fluctuations that aren't big enough to do anything much, and then you hit some critical one, and that's it. We are missing correlations. I don't know if that is readable. It's not actually on my screen at this size, but there we worked out what the two-point correlation function is. And at 1 and 2 steps, it's significant, and there's a significant anti-correlation. But once you get past that, the correlation becomes extremely small. And since the basic physics here is coming from these extreme events at the tail, we're pretty sure that the correlations, while they might shift the numbers a little bit, aren't going to make very much difference.
Wait a minute, isn't there there's an average null energy condition?
Right.
So if you have at one of these, well, no, extreme positive does have to be accompanied by right. negative the other way.
Which yeah, right.
So this is probably why there's an average null energy condition.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, the energy would want to be a little bit negative all the time. And it must be the scale which is causing it to be positive on
yeah. average. Or you could put it the other way around. The reason that, given that there's a lower limit on the fluctuations, the reason that the distribution is sharply peaked around that lower limit is that it has to balance this infinite tail.
Yeah, but I'm just, if you have one of these big positive spikes, would you expect it to be accompanied?
Doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter because the fluctuation kills you before you hit the negative.
Well, the fluctuation, no, it's not even that. It's because the Ray-Chaudhry equation is nonlinear, and once you have a big enough positive fluctuation, there is no possible negative fluctuation that can overcome the contribution of the the expansion squared. So once you got a big enough positive fluctuation, you're dead.
It's also a classical equation, which you know, you should be fluctuating the metric as well. I guess you're multiplying that again by large N or something like that.
Right. Yeah, that's what I said at the beginning, that I don't know how to do that. And so I'm saying, well, let's look at large N or something like that, or at scales, where maybe I can get away with treating fluctuations as a metric as just another spin 2 field in the background.
But the passive fluctuations of the metric affect the matter fields too.
Right.
So is this under control in the sense that you can say you get this extreme negative fluctuation in a way that doesn't remove itself?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that certainly in for the two-dimensional theory, this is completely under control. For four dimensions, the calculations haven't been done for the probability distribution for massless spin 2, but it seems unlikely to me that they would be drastically different. Possible. I don't know. That ought to be checked.
And this is sort of an obvious point, but when you calculate these probability distributions, this is, involves assuming a boundary condition on a parthenon on basically one side of this. I mean, if I looked for distributions where this thing never occurs, I could find them, or?
No, the probability distribution here is the probability distribution of fluctuation, vacuum fluctuations of the stress energy tensor of various massless fields. And it's the Minkowski vacuum, that's just...
But you have a boundary condition on theta implicit in this, right?
What? No.
The expansion.
No.
No.
No. No. I'm saying I have some fields in the universe, they're in the vacuum state, they're undergoing quantum fluctuations. Let me just take an arbitrary initial theta and see what happens. I mean, for the simulations, we started at theta equals 0, but that didn't matter because theta was immediately within one step driven up to theta max. If we had started with theta greater than theta max, it would have immediately within one or two steps been driven down to theta max. You essentially always start at the same, at a physically determined value, which is the place that it's pushed to by these large numbers of negative energy fluctuations.
Okay.
So because of this null condition, I asked the average to 0.
It is an average null energy condition, but the integral over a GD signal is always positive.
But you're in a vacuum state here, so it doesn't affect average to 0, right?
Yeah.
But that, doesn't that mean that you have to have these positive excursions?
Yes.
So you don't actually have to do the calculation. You could have just come and said.
Well, no, it could have been. Well, the calculations, first of all, we had to do the calculation to figure out how much time this would take. But beyond that, it could have been that you always had positive excursions, but that they were never big enough to force you past this critical point. It's only when you know that at the positive side you have an infinite tail, or at least a tail that goes past the negative limit, and that it's, you sort of need to say it's a big enough tail that this will that you don't have to wait the age of the universe to see a fluctuation at the Planck scale.
Okay.
But yeah, you could, somebody could have said as soon as it was recognized that there was an infinite positive tail, this must happen. That's a sign of an interesting result, right? That people say, well, we should have seen that a long time ago.
So do you expect massive
things to behave very differently? Because here it's all messiness, right?
I have almost no intuition about that. I would guess not. I would guess not. But yeah, yeah. I would yeah. So I would think not. But
he wants to pick a length afterwards to be not plunking.
Right. When you start looking at the yeah, then you need to worry about that. Although I suspect there are enough massless or nearly massless fields around. I mean, one. So I think, yeah. Okay, four dimensions. Unfortunately, there are. The results here are not nearly as good as they are. There's no closed form known for this probability distribution. And the moments don't fall off fast enough to allow the application of this theorem implying a unique probability distribution. I don't remember. I would have to. I can look that up, but I don't remember. There are pretty convincing arguments, though, that when the probability distribution is not unique, that it takes some very, to get, there's an obvious one, and then there are others that are really bizarre and that require fluctuations in probability that are extremely fast. But be that as it may, we don't know. So far, the probability distributions have only been calculated for the TT component of the stress energy tensor, and not the null-null component, which is the one that we would want. But the XX component is also can also be read off and is from their work and is not significantly different from the TT component. So one might hope that the null-null component isn't drastically different either. But that needs to be worked out, and that hasn't been done yet. Using their approximate fit for this probability distribution, there is again a lower bound for the smeared component of the stress energy tensor. There's an infinite positive tail, and this behavior, the x to the minus 2, and, pardon?
Is that -0.04?
Yeah. Yes, that's a minus. Yes, it's a very small minus sign. yeah, that's minus. The form of this tail is certain, although the coefficient, there could be a coefficient up here of order 1, and there's some unknown coefficient in front there, but they're rigorous upper and lower bounds. Given their estimated distribution for electromagnetism, the probability of a large fluctuation is 0.014. We can't do the simulations because we don't have the exact distribution, but given how well this back of the envelope estimate worked for the case that we could do things exactly, there's some hope that it should work here as well, and that gives a collapse time of 70 times the smearing time, or 70 Planck times, say.
So
roughly.
I'm just confusing it. If the smearing length was much bigger than the Planck time, then this wouldn't just scale linearly, right? So what is it?
You just mean 70 length Planck when tau equals length Planck?
Yeah.
So that's
right.
Okay.
But this isn't a general function of tau.
That's right.
That's right.
This is with. There is an implicit assumption in here that everything is measured in Planck units, which they did not make explicit. It takes some teasing out of their paper, but Yeah. So converting back to getting out the results. I did this a year ago, and I don't remember how the thing scales.
Is smearing only in the time direction?
This is smearing in the time direction, yeah.
So no spatial smearing.
Right. But for four dimensions, spatial smearing actually doesn't do you much good, but...
Time is usually time, enough for
yeah,
your field.
Right.
Why does the probability distribution depend on Newton's constant?
It is a... Because... Yeah.
In some sense, the probability distribution doesn't. Its effect on the ratio during your equation does. You convert the region inserts a gene times the
Yeah, that's her.
It's just that.
But this is right, but this calculation for probability of T shouldn't
vary. Well, right. If by large you mean bigger than
That critical thing that
number.
Right.
Yeah, the problem is getting it bigger than the critical value, which depends on Newton's constant.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, I guess what you're just looking at that distribution, what in fact must be true is that if you're looking at if tau is much bigger than the Planck length, that time becomes exponentially long because you have to live way far out on the tail to get something big enough to drive you into this critical regime. I mean, it seems like it's not even a power law. It seems like it's an
extra. Yeah, except that you have to work out what happens with the lower bound as well. And, well, where you have to go out on the tail depends on what happens with the lower bound. And then once you get there, you don't have to go out much farther on the tail than that. Okay, so let me now move on to the really wild speculation portion of the talk. Up to here, I'm pretty confident of this. And the question is what it means.
The fluctuations at the tail, these are fluctuations which carry energy of order of kinetic energy.
Yeah.
So, are you really comfortable? You have energy concentrated in Planckian scales of order of the Planck mass, and you're ignoring the back reaction.
Yeah, because it's nonlinear.
I'm not exactly sure that you should.
Yeah, okay, well, right. So the question is how close to the Planck scale you can get and still trust this. I mean, there's a factor of 70 here.
Oh, but that probably has to do with the question that Alan was raising, putting the units back in.
Yeah.
Because there are really three, there's the energy,
mm-hmm.
there's the Planck scale, and then there's the time scale that you're waiting.
Right.
So it's not just...
Well, yeah, I mean, the crucial thing here is this lower bound, which is a 20th, which is 20 times, it's a 20th of the, or 20 times, depending on how, well, no, it's 20 times the Planck length, or, so here you're going to get a factor of 1 over 20 to the fourth. So it's well below Planck energy. But I agree, you have to worry about where you really have to start thinking about the quantum gravitational effects. And what I'm going to argue next in the wild speculation part is that this may mean that you have to start thinking about quantum gravitational effects at something like this scale and not at the Planck scale.
Let me just see if I'm visualizing this correctly. In the case where tau is greater than the Planck length, you're saying it's a power law, it's not because of the exponential tail. So I'm supposed to imagine this, that if I smear over a macroscopic distance, then the fluctuations in the stress tensor are quite small compared to the Planck mass, but it's just I'm going to get a fluctuation which is large enough that it's too big to be compensated for by fluctuations of the size that I have.
Right.
And then that means I will reach the Planck regime, but after it, or they will converge, focus, and I might have a quantum gravity regime that will take me a lot longer after that moment of
yes.
time. It'll just be sort of inevitably rolling down
right.
towards it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you're right. And that's for the macroscopic effects, that's where the big difference is, that it's not primarily the amount of time that it takes to get a large fluctuation, which does just depend on the smearing time. But it's a question of once you get one of these, how long does it take for you to notice? Okay, wild speculation. First, what does this mean for space-time structure? Okay, take a little space-like surface in your space-time. Little meaning few hundred Planck areas or something like that. But any space-like surface you want. And look at the light cones from points coming out of that surface. What this is telling you is that if you're looking at the Planck scale, that in fairly short order, the light cones converge. What that's telling you is that there is some sense in which regions on this surface or on its time translation are much less in causal contact than you would expect.
All right, so I have to ask.
Okay.
If I do this in the four-dimensional case,
mm-hmm.
what you've convinced me is if I travel along any given light ray,
uh-huh.
there'll be some point where it costs this.
Yeah.
Arouses. But of course, if I start with what you just said, I think what you said, if I look at a point and look at the light cone at that point, it's expanding, right? So at a given time, I mean, is there a time when all of the generators are cosmic? Or do I just get little bits of them kind of all over?
All I know is that at this point is that the expansion goes to minus infinity. So the area of the cross-section of this light cone shrinks to zero.
That's probably true for the entire light cone and not just for...
Now you can prove
yeah.
it, because if you take any region, you look at the future, you look at the boundary, I just did this in my relativity class, you look at the boundary of the future, right?
Yeah.
And the boundary of the future is ruled by null geodesics, which have to stay on the boundary until
yeah.
you come back.
Sure.
Now, if they're all going to be caustics, I mean, if they're going to be caustics within a finite time...
Well, that's my question, Joe.
Well, we have not proven that.
Well,
yeah.
But you have an estimate.
We know that usually it happens at that
yeah.
time. But what
right.
if most of them caustic? What if it's a little...
Right.
Most of them caustic, but what if the ones that don't caustic sort of repopulate?
Oh, I see. The rare
yeah.
ones.
The rare ones.
Right.
Might not grow.
Right. Yeah.
That was my question.
Right. Yes.
It's not that scenario.
Yes. And, yeah. and that's one of the things that I don't know. And that, I'm worried about that, and I don't even really know how to think about it properly, given
it
tools.
Power lines
but, yeah. So, yeah. So that's part of what makes this piece wild speculation. So there is some average sense, at least, in which you expect that nearby areas on this surface, on any space-like surface that you start with, are decouple. Now, for people who've worked in various obscure kinds of cosmology, this is very familiar. This is a phenomenon that is known in cosmology as asymptotic silence. Near a space-like, a generic space-like singularity, this is the kind of behavior that you have. You have light cones shrinking to time-like lines. It's asymptotic silence because nearby points can't talk to each other. It's also sometimes called the anti-Newtonian limit. It's the effective speed of light going to zero. In the cosmological setting, this has been studied extensively. What happens is that when your spatial points decouple, you get BKL behavior. That is, that you get separate regions, each small regions, each of which looks like a mixmaster universe. That is, Kasner with random bounces that change the Kasner axes and the relative expansion rates. So it is interesting to speculate that maybe this is an indication that the same thing happens generically at short distances. There's another piece of evidence for this from a different approach, which is that if you look at the strong coupling limit of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, which is something people worked on a lot in the 1980s. If you look at the limit that the Planck length becomes very large, what happens with the Wheeler-DeWitt equation is that the only term involving spatial derivatives of the metric goes away. So again, you have decoupling of points. Not quite, because you still have the momentum constraints, but it is still roughly true that in this strong coupling limit, the classical solutions where you make these into a momenta are known in the LP infinite limit. They're just Kasner. You put in a finite value of the but large value of the Planck length. You get BKL behavior again. And while the work on the quantum theory isn't conclusive, there's some pretty good evidence that you just naturally get coherent states that are centered around BKL-like geometries. There is one other piece of possible physics which this might also be relevant to. And this is some results from causal dynamical triangulations. Causal dynamical triangulations is a Reggie calculus approach to the path integral with the additional feature that a fixed topological time slicing is put in, which prevents baby universes from budding off, and actually seems to give very nice classical limits. I mean, you get averages that really look like De Sitter space. There is this really interesting and very poorly understood result, though, in causal dynamical triangulations, that if you measure the dimension of space-time as a spectral dimension, that is, by looking at diffusion rates, that it's 4 at large distances, which is what you want. But if you look at it at small distances, the spectral dimension goes down smoothly to something that within calculation, within computational errors, is 2. So in some sense, in CDT at least, space-time looks two-dimensional at small scales. Well, so does Kasner space. If you are looking at Kasner space from the point of view of spectral dimension, if you take Kasner space and you start with a random geodesic, some initial point but an arbitrary initial direction and velocity, and you look at the proper distance that it travels, what you find is that geodesics in Kasner space essentially explore only one dimension of the space, that the proper distance that they travel in in the two, well, depending on what time direction you're looking at, the two dimensions that are behaving differently from the third. The proper distance that they travel in those two is very small compared to the proper distance in the unique direction. Which means, presumably, that if one looks at a diffusion process, one should get something that looks two-dimensional. There have been various attempts to actually calculate the heat kernel from which you could get the spectral dimension in Kasner space. Nobody's done it in closed form, but in the approximations that exist, you really do get at some scales spectral dimension that's very nearly two. Hu and O'Connor looked at this many years ago and talked about the effective IR dimension. So I have no idea whether this is what's going on in CDT, but I have a student who is working on looking at the structure of light cones in causal dynamical triangulations with the aim of looking at whether they are eccentric, and whether they're highly eccentric at short distances and then widen out at large distances. I'll let you know in a year. Well, maybe 2 years. It takes a lot of computation to get a fine enough lattice to be able to see enough of the light cone to be able to tell.
Last which student?
This is Charles Pierce, who you probably have not met, but if you come to PCGM 29, you can.
Unfortunately, I won't be.
Well, your loss. Okay, so that's it. Do vacuum fluctuations focus geodesics? Yes, almost certainly, with characteristic times of that are on the order of the Planck time, but perhaps big enough to be able to trust the calculations. We need a better analysis of the 3+1 dimensional case. And it is conceivable that it has these very interesting implications for the small-scale structure of space-time, although it's equally conceivable that that's total nonsense. But time will tell. Thank you.
So if I think about this from the perspective of the microscopic theory, where I'm not just assuming that there's a continuum at large distances, microscopically, if there's this focusing going on, I would worry that there wouldn't really be a good continuum limit at all, that that's in fact what the result is saying, is that I'll find, you know, your picture of the small-scale space is like being very close to a singularity, that you just get a singularity almost everywhere, which would make me wonder, maybe there's just nothing at bigger scales.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't have a good answer to that. I mean, presumably, when you get from this scale to the scale where you're really interested, to something closer to the Planck scale, the whole argument breaks down. At least there's no reason to trust it anymore. One can easily imagine a situation in which there is this BKL-like behavior at very small scales, but in which a macroscopic average doesn't show it, because the directions, the preferred directions are also varying over the Planck scale, and the relative expansion rates are varying over the Planck time and so on. But I certainly don't know how to show that that's what actually happens.
It just turns out it's only that there's caustics on some of the light rays, then that's not all that disturbing. I mean, random light sheets usually have caustics.
Yeah, but this is saying that there are caustics on most of them, and that given any pair, there's a high probability that there'll be a caustic.
Right, so if there's caustics on all of them, then you have singularity theorem type results. So I guess the question is going between most and all.
Right. Well, the other thing is that this, you don't necessarily have caustics. You get convergence to the Planck scale, at which point
maybe
you have to deal with the things that I don't know how to deal with.
Other questions?
Yeah, I'm a little uncomfortable about one aspect of this. So, your sort of argument about geodesic focusing is very classical. It's a Jaffari equation, classical space-time, classical geodesics, the usual thing. And you're putting in the quantum fluctuations in the stress tensor only, you know, in the sense like, you know, as if the geodesics are coming along and every so often they sort of measure the energy density they're feeling and they pick something and then a little later they measure it again and they feel something.
Yeah.
I mean, isn't it, to do it more consistently, wouldn't you expect some probability distribution of, say, geodesic focusing, which would then be somehow correlated with the probability distribution in the matter?
Well, it is. It is a probability distribution of the curvature. That's what feeds into the equation.
I mean, before people take the expectation value, you just get a classical stress tensor that could couple to the metric. You don't want to do that.
Right.
But he's effectively done that. He's put in, he's supposed from simplicity that the stress tensor is independent here, 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 and here.
Okay.
And that's what his runs are. They're sampling the ensemble of convergences you get when you propagate through this ensemble of stress tensors.
I see. So we're doing all those 10 million runs. Right.
We have, Right. Yeah, and the only thing that we've pulled out of that is the time to convergence. But in principle, we could give me some other interesting variables, and I'll see what can we can pull out.
Relations between, describe it that way, one describe the motion, the sampling, the probability distribution. Taking out all the correlations between the energy monitors at one point and another point.
Right. But that is... That's these. We have taken them out, but they are extremely small except for the very closest point.
Have you taken into account this very closest one?
No, we haven't.
Because actually, I'm suddenly very worried about this, because the in the vacuum state, the average null energy is zero as an operator equation. It's not just about expectation, it's an operator equation. So if you're right that there's no correlation on long distance scales, that seems to me to say on the short distance scales, it always integrates to zero.
Yeah.
So if you have one of these huge positive peaks,
it's one there and minus five there, minus five there.
It's got to have the negative energy close by.
That's right. The point is that the negative energy doesn't help. The point is that once you have one of the positive peaks, the right-hand side of the Ray-Chaudhry equation is negative enough that even if you had the maximum possible negative energy fluctuation, the right-hand side would stay negative. And then your next largest possible negative fluctuation would do you even less good, because by then your expansion has gotten larger, and so the right-hand side is more negative.
So when you say you haven't taken the short distance correlations into account, you just mean you haven't taken into account in interpreting the exact, and calculating the exact time scale for this to occur.
Yes, that's right.
Not that you have an argument that says it can't.
Yes.
This argument suggests it can't eliminate it altogether.
Yeah, it certainly, I think that it is this classic gambler's ruin. There is no way, as soon as you know that there can be positive energy fluctuations that are large enough to make the right-hand side here negative enough that it has to stay negative,
it does have to be positive for a while, right? I mean, if it were just very positive for a very short period of time.
Well, we're smearing over the Planck time.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So it has to be positive for a Planck time. I mean, in the simulations, what we're doing is running in Planck time steps. It could be that the answer is that the proper smearing time is, well, I don't know. If you make it much less than the Planck time, I think you get even more rapid collapse. Unless you have some way of completely decoupling the smearing time from the evolution time,
what if it's positive because there's a giant like delta function, not quite the just very sharp peak that's much sharper than the smearing length, and then it's immediately followed by a negative one, and it's just negative lower down on the where the smearing takes it into account a little bit less. Not physically realistic.
I think that you can rule that out because the probability distribution is known as a function of the smearing time. So it ought to be possible to check that, but I'm pretty sure that isn't what happens.
Maybe I'm following up on Gary's question. I was a little confused. It seems like the calculation you did, again, would be correct if the photon or whatever that was passing through this geometry was actually measuring it.
Mm-hmm.
So that these were, I mean, you're using classical statistics here, as if you're actually measuring the geometry.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not, I mean, is it, maybe you should use a, you should, I guess the smearing scale should be the scale over which that's a good approximation, and that a passing photon will actually sort of decohere the different fluctuations of the geometry, the different fluctuations of the stress energy. I mean, is it clear that should be so small? I mean, I might have guessed it might be of order the wavelength of the photon or something like that, and that you shouldn't be smearing anywhere near the Planck scale.
Yeah.
He's assuming he has arbitrarily small wavelengths.
I'm trying to probe the structure of space-time at some distances that are a little bit bigger but not hugely bigger than the Planck scale. So to do that, I have to assume that I have probes at that scale.
Okay.
It's an abstraction.
What does it mean
but,
that you've gotten that result? If you probe it at a larger scale, you don't see decoupling performance.
Right. I don't know. It means that the actual wave function of the quantum wave function of the metric has different structure at different scales, and that if you look at it at small enough scales, it looks, it's peaked around one set of geometries. And if you look at it at where you're averaging over larger scales, it's peaked somewhere else.
What is that when you do get focusing down to the Planck scale, there's an extra repulsion that kicks in and it doesn't actually cost it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I have no idea what happens at the Planck scale, and I've been trying to avoid it. But yeah, could be.
So I'm worried again. I know it happens very rapidly.
Oh, you must have a frustrating.
Some of the things you've told me don't quite seem consistent.
Okay.
So if you have a large positive peak, mm-hmm. it must be balanced by negative energy. But the negative energy has a minimum possible value, which means it must be negative value spread out over many time steps. Well, but you just said that the correlation function of the stress energy tensor falls off very quickly. It must be the contingent on the fact that we have this giant positive peak it's no longer true that we expect.
It's not so giant. It's only twice. The ones he's after are only twice the size, the most negative fluctuation.
Yeah.
Right. They said there were ones arbitrarily big.
Right, but you don't need
when they occur.
For the ones that he's worried about, they're only twice this characteristic size. You can compensate for them in two time steps.
Yeah.
But you agree that if there is a really big one, what I'm saying?
Yes. There is a really big one, there has to be something.
And then this correlation function was probably very misleading in that case because it concerns a very rare event.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you can see from this correlation function exactly the kind of cancellation that you're looking for, that you have a correlation of 1 at 0 and minus 0.5 on either side of it. That's that cancellation. But yeah, it's certainly true that if you have, if you are way, way out on the tail, that this isn't, but again, it still doesn't help you, because once you have a fluctuation that big, you can have as much negative energy you want, and you're still doomed.
But coming back to, so you're saying that your logic is, I'd like to see what space-time looks like in short distances. Mm-hmm. I send in light bars.
Yeah.
And try to see these.
Yeah.
But if you're actually going to do that, coming back to your question about an observable experiment, send in wave packets, and you choose frequencies that were close, or wavelengths that were close to the plankton.
Right, and so there would be huge energy and huge back reaction.
Which you haven't taken into account.
Right, that's right.
So what would be an operational way that you could actually detect, you know, run into this conclusion that space-time is order, you could cause a disconnection. Right.
Although that would seem to only make it worse, right? You're adding...
Make it worse, it would make it...
More positive energy.
Validate his... You would have other sources of curvature in the experiment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But if you're more positive energy.
But is this an experiment that you could do, because you'd be introducing larger?
You certainly.
Or any classical sources.
Yeah. So you couldn't do it that way.
Well, that's all you.
I don't know. I wouldn't. I don't. I'll bet that a clever enough quantum optics person could figure out some way of probing this kind of thing, but I don't have a good answer to that. I think if you have this sort of dimensional reduction at a few hundred times the Planck scale, say, or 100 times the Planck scale, it's certainly not something that you'll be able to observe directly by sending things in with wavelengths that are short enough to measure that. Because, as you say, the back reaction is much too large. I don't know how you would measure it. My hope is that where this would lead is to a new set of approximations for quantum gravity, that if you have this effective dimensional reduction, then there might be some at least approximate two-dimensional model of gravity at this scale, which one might be able to understand the quantum mechanics of and then figure out implications there. For a direct observation of this effect, I think that what it would require is smearing it large, much larger scales, and then I have to work out exactly whether that's observable.
Okay.
It's a back of the envelope calculation I did about a year ago, seemed to indicate that if you looked at galaxies at UV wavelengths, I think, halfway across the universe, that there might be caustics, but it was a very rough estimate. So maybe at the edge of observability.
All right, are there any more questions? Not? Thanks, Dave, again.